Life is full of personal wins, whether it's cleaning your house, getting that dream car, or checking off your to-do list. Winning at life is a great feeling. And with the State Farm Personal Price Plan, you can keep winning when you create an affordable price just for you by bundling home and auto. So give yourself a round of applause. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase.
Welcome to the Rest Podcast number 913. This episode's Greg Kinnear. I was so excited to have Greg Kinnear on. I have always adored him. I met him very early on when I first started working at MTV, and he was real nice to me, and I've always just rooted for him.
Yeah,
he's funny. He sort of changed the way cable shows are made. You know, it's like he changed it, and then he had this amazing career on top of that.
Yeah, I always, you know, he was so great. It was so cool to see him transition from being like a really funny host on Talk Soup
to be an Oscar nominated actor.
I mean, it's almost just because of that that fact was one of the funniest moments in the Larry Sanders Show.
I brought that up on the episode.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
For what? Talk Soup
with Tom Petty.
Yeah, exactly.
Rest in peace.
Yeah.
Yeah, we talked about that.
Oh, that's awesome.
Because they said it totally freaked him out.
You know,
that was, he was like, I have to do what? With whom?
Oh, yeah.
But again, sorry you weren't at that one too, Jonah.
Yeah.
But I love that you pop in for the intros now.
Yeah, I'm here and there. I'll do what I can. I do my best. Always have.
A little deadbeat dad, though.
A little bit.
Hey, I'll come in for one of your intros.
Doesn't it mean that I like your company more than these
than
celebrities? These vapid celebrities you parade on in here. You know what? You think I want to see them? I want to see you. What happened to my friend?
He's dead, Jonah.
He's actually more back now than I've ever known him.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I have more time now.
Yeah, you know, we're talking about it. It's like, it feels like Chris is back. Not that, like, you were gone, but it's just you were so busy all the time.
Well, yeah. I mean, doing a daily television show takes a lot of energy.
Yeah. Brain space.
It takes a lot of brain space, and then it moves everything else that you would normally do on those days into the remaining little slivers of time.
Yeah, exactly.
And so you're just all the time like, what am I supposed to do? So it's nice. It's nice to be back. It was good seeing you guys the other night at the Walking Dead premiere.
Yeah, that was a blast. That was a lot of fun.
Thanks for
inviting us.
It was play the Greek.
Yeah, the Greek. You got Kyle Clark up there warming up the crowd.
I was leaving, I said goodbye to Norman Reedus, and he was talking to this guy named Ian. And I talked to this guy named Ian, and I go, wow, he looks familiar. He looks really familiar. And then I just started getting clues pieced together. And Norman asked him, like, oh, you guys played here? And he was like, yeah, we played the Greek before. And then he mentioned his age, being 55, and it just didn't register. And then literally 2 days later, I was like,
Ian Curtis.
That was Ian Astbury.
Oh, Ian Astbury. Oh, wow. It was like a musician. Ian, what do I got?
Yeah. So I'm pretty sure that was Ian Astbury that I was talking to for 10 minutes. And he's lucky that I didn't, that at the moment, I wasn't like, oh, yeah, because I fucking love the Cult.
Yeah.
So
that's really rad. He lives in that area, I think.
Oh, he does?
Yeah. My brother, like, dog sits for him sometimes.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Yeah. That night was so, one of my favorite moments was like when you're on stage and you were talking to Greg Nicotero, and then he like brought up George Romero, rest in peace, and then like talked about like the reference of to Day of the Dead.
Yep.
And then the severed head.
His
puppet,
severed head, yeah.
You know? But then like, you know, but then also what I was like, not near, but down the same row as Tom Savini.
Oh, shit.
The godfather of, you know, modern gore effects. And so during the episode, when they're screening the episode, every time there was like a gore or an effect moment, I would look down at Tom Savini just to see.
Just
like,
to wait to see if he would nod or go shake his head.
Yeah. And every once in a while, it's like a real graphic kill or something like that. I'd look over at him and like he'd kind of go, like nodding his head like, yeah. I was like, ah, this is so neat.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, this is Greg Kinnear. He's promoting Same Kind of Different as Me, which is in theaters now. And Katie, would you be so kind as to roll the thing.
In 5, 4, 3.
Hold the roll.
And 5, 4.
Cut. Okay. All right, Jonah, you're right in the camera. This is a podcast. Why are you in the
camera? I'd go back to 1, but I have to start at 5.
Okay.
5, 4, 3.
Oh, you're not going to say the last?
You don't say 2 and 1.
Why?
Because of Wayne's World.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Just or Catholic mom guilt. I'll just let my mom come over and just passive aggressively just make the termites feel bad about why they're here, but no, not in a way that is directly threatening.
Yeah, but they still won't leave. Even with a horrific mother-in-law, they won't leave. They're comfortable here. There's a lot of delicious, chunky, crisp wood pieces for them to gnaw on. They're not going anywhere soon. I gotta
sure,
tell
just
you.
Eat their house. Why not? Yeah. Sure, just eat their house. Enjoy. Yeah. I hope you're having fun. I hope you guys are having fun.
This is really good, this house.
You can really taste the years of desperation and being in Hollywood for, 80 years, this house.
Yes.
I don't know if you remember the first time that we ever met.
I do.
You do?
I do remember the first time we met.
Okay, when do you think it was? And
but I'm going to let you tell the story.
Oh, you son of a bitch. I started working for MTV in 1994.
Okay.
And was of course a huge fan of Talk Soup.
Uh-huh.
And I came over to, where were you guys shooting that? Some studio, whatever, there was a studio where you were shooting that. And I met you, and it was, you were leaving the show. And I go, and I think I just blurted out, I was like, how can I take over this show? And you go, oh, you want to host the soup, huh? And I go, I do. And you were like, well, and you were not in control of that decision.
Yes.
So you were like, well, good luck. You were very nice, but
doesn't sound like me.
but told Tom, your stage manager, Tom.
Tom, sure.
Who
Tom.
I worked with for years after that.
Yes. Yeah. Tom and. I don't know if John Esposito was still
John
there.
Esposito was on Singled Out. I worked with John on Singled Out.
And Perrin Spaghetti, I made up his last name. He was another one
Italian.
Of our characters. We, it was just such a lonely group in there of like 3 or 4 of us trying to fill a half hour of daytime television clips. But it was, such a... I look back on it very fondly, obviously. And hey, man, things worked out for you.
Things are fine. I'm not complaining.
Just fine. Other than the termite infestation here at the house,
God,
the floors are a little loose, but you're going to be just fine.
It's fine. When by the time the floors are all gone and it's just the studs of the house because the termites have consumed everything.
It's funny enough. I probably to some degree. The reason I am here, the reason that we ran into each other at the Talk Soup hallway years ago was because of MTV.
That's right.
Did you know that I auditioned for MTV?
No, I don't think I did know that.
Yeah, okay.
For what?
Well, if we set the clock back to like 1947
sure,
or something
that,
whenever MTV was still had the stairs and you had J.J. Johnson and Martha
J.J. Jackson,
Quinn.
Martha Quinn.
Yes, exactly. And I had a friend of mine who was dating Justine Bateman.
Uh-huh.
We're talking family ties days.
That, those were good days, yeah.
And she had just hosted something at MTV, like a Super Bowl. Remember how the MTV would go to the Super Bowl and they'd have the Super Bowl party? And Justine somehow was tied with that. And my buddy said, hey, listen, we told this girl at MTV about you. I have no idea why. I was working for a marketing low-budget film company, basically just trying to pass the days here. But they thought maybe I could go be a VJ. And so I actually went to New York somehow through somebody who knew somebody who knew somebody. I got an audition out there and sat on those stairs and said, hey,
hey, all you cool cats, this is Greg Kinnear, man. We're just going to play some tunes and talk today. And needless to say, it was a total faceplant, horrible audition. And
his voice is entirely too squeaky. I mean, that's not even a real voice.
You think I went too high? That probably was a mistake, you know, come to think of it. But I didn't get the job, but I got a nice tape out of it, and it said MTV Audition on it. And so I ended up, there was another channel starting up in LA before E was E. It was called Movie Time. And I dropped the tape off and they saw MTV Audition on it. And they were so impressed by that, that somebody was had an MTV Audition tape, that it got me an audition there and kind of got me my first job.
That's insane. I mean, Talk Soup really was, it really sort of ushered in the 90s and sort of a new way to approach television, because it really, by the time the 90s came along, we as a culture started to admit there might be too many channels of, and not all of the stuff is great.
Yeah.
And so Talk Soup was really the first show that I can remember that had a direct conversation with the audience of, look how dumb all this shit is. You know, it was like really the first. And it's so funny that even still people are replicating that formula. But you guys, you and Tom and Jonas, was just those couple of guys in the studio, legitimately were just trying to make each other laugh. But that became the way to do a show. And then by the time Joel took over the Soup, there was an audience and it was a whole thing. And, you know, but back then it would really just seem like you guys were in a closet and someone said, we're not going to let you out of this until you, almost like Mystery Science Theater, we're not going to let you out of this closet until you talk about all these horrible shows.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anybody, I mean, the network, like, didn't know we were on the air for the first year. and we were given just a complete open license to kind of do anything. And it was very liberating. I suddenly was doing that show and feeling like, God, there really are no rules here. We really can do anything we want. And this shit is bad. So I think we will have a little fun with this, because the initial idea was to do a very serious look with a coat and tie at the highlights of today's Geraldo Rivera episode. And that very quickly just seemed like, well, that ain't going to work. So it just got wilder and wilder in there. But it was a great place to start.
I mean, that period of the glut during the daytime talk show gold rush of the 90s, where it just, and that went on for quite a while, but every, you know, and they all started off like, no, we're going to be like Phil Donahue. We're really going to, and it just quickly got into,
right,
are you the father of this baby? Like, it just so fast.
So crazy. That's so true, man. They take one look at that first week of ratings, and whether you are Morton Downey Jr. or Sally Jesse Raphael, we're going to have to amp this shit up. And you'd immediately go, it wasn't long before the, the whatever crazy scenario they would bring.
Alien babies.
Yeah.
It didn't matter. It was, I guess they just sort of realized, like, yeah, the majority of people really don't want an incisive take of every different talk show with real social issues. They really, people just want tabloid gunk.
That's right.
To distract them from the world.
I met Oprah years later at a dinner, and I complimented her because she was the only one enough not to give us a clip. And I was like, was that you or was that somebody else? And she said, no, I did. I don't remember, but we all kind of knew maybe that wasn't the best place for us to be having clips of our show. But I was always quite admirable. I thought it was very admirable of them to refuse us.
Did any of those hosts have a good sense of humor about what was going on, or were, did
yeah.
you?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, good. They had to know.
Yeah, Jerry Springer. You know, I mean, across the board, I think. You know, I went and did like a thing in New York where we literally went to the shows. We did an episode like that. So, you know, they obviously were in on it at that point, and it was okay. And they seemed, you know, listen, as long as we were tagging what time the next episode was coming on and who was on it, we didn't pay a cent for the clips. That was the genius of it, is it was all free, everything. I had some spoons floating behind me in a green screen, and they paid me, I don't know, just above minimum wage. And And they, the clips themselves were considered, you know, since it was promotional and fair use, because we were going to plug what was coming up tomorrow on the show, everything was a gimme. So I think everybody had some sense of humor about it. Yeah, it was okay.
Well, it was also a period of time where you did something that was very, highly uncommon, and having worked at MTV during that time, but the entertainment business used to be very compartmentalized. And so that if you were, even if you were a cable person, the network didn't really take you seriously. If you were a specific kind of cable person, like working at MTV, other cable channels were like, nah, they're MTV people. They're not really, you know, and then to then go do movies was crazy. And so to watch you jump from a cable show on a deep cable channel, which was very successful at the time, but still it was a deep cable channel, to fucking, like, the biggest movies. I mean, it's that leap. That was like, oh my God, one of us got out. How'd he get out? Jesus Christ, Craig, throw back a lifeline, buddy. What are you doing? He's swimming away.
He's climbing over the wall.
I'm relieved, but also sad, because I'm, Greg, throw a fucking ladder down. And then just gone.
Yeah.
I mean, when you look at your, the first two movies you did, at least what I saw on your IMDb, it was like, Blank Man, Sabrina. Like, it's like the...
yeah.
So what was the... Is the lore true? It's like, oh, Gary Marshall loved Talk Soup and just said, I want to put that guy in a movie.
You know, I think he... No, that wasn't the case. With regard to Sabrina, Sidney Pollack had Lindsay Duran was working for Sidney Pollack. She was an executive at Paramount. He had been trying to cast Harrison Ford's brother in that movie for a long time. I mean, they were Carrot Top had passed at this point. I mean, it was they were really at the end of their rope. And I think Lindsay pointed out to him, said, hey, have you ever seen this show Talk Soup? To which he, like many others, said no. And he said, bring me a tape of it, a half-inch VHS cassette for you kids out there.
Yeah, we used to have to carry our media around in duffel bags.
And he checked it out, and he said, oh, wow, well, bring me an 8x10 or something. And on the back, of course, you list your various bio information. I am from a small town called Logansport, Indiana. Lived there until I was about 10. Sidney Pollack is from Lafayette, Indiana. So we're not that many miles away from each other. And literally when I met him, he honestly could not believe that anybody was from a smaller town in Indiana than he was. So part of the reason that we ever even had a meeting, this is way before I'm auditioning or reading, was honestly just like he wanted to just talk to a guy from Indiana. And then eventually I did audition and they put me on tape. And so it was a crazy, left-hand turn that only a guy like that, a guy who's in complete control of his career, 800-pound gorilla, and somebody, you know, respected enough in the movie business. And there's not that many guys like this anymore in our business who could say, yeah, I want to take a shot here with this. I mean, you know, so I was very, I was incredibly fortunate for that and appreciative, obviously, of the shot he gave me.
Did you get fun Harrison Ford or gruff Harrison Ford?
Hey, Greg. Yeah, no, he was good. He was great to me, actually. We had lunch in New York. I'm suddenly with Han Solo, having lunch in a restaurant in New York, and I'm like thinking, God, this is really happening right now. And we hadn't started shooting the film yet, and he just, you know, said, let's go grab a bite. And I'm trying to be cool, and my big joke was to say, you know, act like, of course, I didn't know what that movie was or who, you know, what that, and he kind of gave me the sort of appreciative laugh as if he hadn't heard that bad joke 1,000 times before, but he was great. And, I wouldn't say he was gruff. He was really good, and he was great in the movie. He was a pro. I was lucky to get a start with a guy like that.
I mean, it must have been so surreal, because your background is in broadcast journalism, right?
Yeah.
So Was acting ever something that you thought you would wanted to branch into, or really?
Well, my
about?
Background was in, you know, try not to be in prison. I mean, my background was, I had gone to college and I was a broadcast journalism major. I did have interest in news. I genuinely did. Living in overseas, I'd grown up overseas. My father's with the State Department as a kid, and I always thought, well, maybe there's a place there, you know, and that would be a guy in a sport coat and a tie, and that would be the sort of I could say, look, Mom, Dad, I wear a tie to work, you know, and it would just fit some sort of template of all things respectable. I was interested in the news, and what the hell? I figured I could talk to a glass camera and tell stories, but I just never found anywhere in that world after college that was going to provide me with a livelihood. And, you know, kicked around, did some other stuff after school before, you know, getting my first break.
I mean, it's such like a, it's such a Harry Potter story, but for a performer, it's like you're the chosen one, you know. I mean, the amount your life must have changed overnight.
But don't you find that? I mean, you're talking to people all the time on this show, and I find I'm always amazed at how many people have these, you know, have extraordinary, an extraordinary opportunity or a turn or something that shifts. It's not everybody waited tables for 25 years and then got their first break.
No, that's true. But I also feel like sometimes what will happen is that it's, you know, a lot of stuff has been thrown against the wall, and then eventually something kind of tips because of the sheer weight of, like, well, this person's really talented, and sooner or later it was going to happen. And you were so funny and so just the timing of it was so beautiful right out of the box that it really did sort of happen. I mean, I know the soup, the talk soup was for a couple, was it two or three seasons that you did?
I did it 3 years, and then I did Movie Time 3 years before that, which was just sitting in a room and looking at highlights of movie clips and trying to fill an hour a time every day.
Yeah, but it just like all of a sudden you were just in the public consciousness, and it all happened so, you know, even hearing like, well, this was 6 years, but it didn't feel like it happened that quickly.
Yeah.
But when it actually did happen, it was pretty quick. And did you ever consider going into politics at any point, like to follow in your
Oh my God, no. And my father wasn't politics. He was, you know, I mean, he, you know, worked in D.C. and, you know, State Department, got a diplomatic assignment to Beirut, Lebanon in the mid-70s. So we went to Lebanon, and then after that to Athens, Greece, where he was reassigned only because the Middle East, which was the territory that he covered, you know, was a very volatile place. And so there were a lot of Americans at the American embassy in Greece in that time. So I was there for 6 years and went to high school there.
Oh, wow. So what was your comedy influence at that time? Like when you're living abroad in a pre-internet era,
yeah,
like during very formative years.
Yes.
What's your comedy?
Well, I did a radio show called School Days with Greg Kinnear. Days spelled D-A-Z-E. Cutting edge it was. And I followed, it was on the Armed Forces radio station. This is the American Forces Radio and Television Network, a service of AFRTS, serving you, the men and women of the United States Air Force Command. Time at the tone, it's 12 o'clock. Then they'd play the news. Then Casey Kasem would come on for a three-hour block, and then my little show would come on, and it was just an hour. So I guess Casey Kasem was my comedy influence.
Oh, another one. Wow. Hearing that name come up a lot.
You know, those personal call-in dedications would kill me. They were so funny.
You've heard the outtakes, I'm sure. You heard the case.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, yeah. Those are fantastic.
I got to come out of a goddamn up-tempo song and talk about a fucking dog dying. Get Don. He never got Don on the phone.
No, Don never got on never the phone.
Where are those pictures he was supposed to sign?
Yeah, that was great stuff. The truth is, because we couldn't get television over there, there were three shows on Greek television, American shows that would have subtitles on them for the Greeks, so we could watch it and understand it, which was Combat, for some reason, with Vic Morrow, there was Dallas and the Muppet Show.
Oh, wow.
So there's my prime cultural years being influenced by that, just to give you an indication why I haven't had more success in this business. But the one thing that did happen while I was over there was the invention of the VCR. So a friend of mine's dad started to ship back episodes of Saturday Night Live.
Oh, fantastic.
And The Tonight Show. So I saw, you know, I started to see The Tonight Show in the last, you know, my junior, senior year of high school, as well as Saturday Night Live, which was so beyond, it wasn't even like I was warmed up for it. I mean, if you were living here watching television, and by the way, at this time, obviously, Saturday Night Live was still a striking breakthrough across the board, but to go from just such limited cultural influence, such limited television, to all of a sudden, the idea of that was, it was like, oh my gosh, this is wonderful. And by the way, back to MTV, I'll say when I first saw in MTV where I was, when I first saw MTV, I don't know, must have been early 80s.
Yeah, 81, I think it launched.
That was a breakthrough. That was a huge moment too, where I don't know, these things started happening where you realized it wasn't going to be like it used to be anymore.
Right. Yeah, well, because what they started realizing was, and it's continued to happen, but they realized that, oh, there are niche audiences, and a niche audience is actually good because it's super focused and we know who the audience is, rather than the old programming model of like, well, let's just try to get as many people as possible in the world to watch this one thing. It's like MTV was for this crowd, and it might have been a smaller number, but it was a really passionate audience.
That's right.
And so and then of course the internet even divided that up an infinite number of ways.
Yeah.
So now we're just in a culture where nothing is too popular because everyone kind of has their own little niche to go down.
I know, it's all been slightly neutralized, which is why it seems like all of the big epic things that happen that we are all talking about are either coming out of the news, they're coming out of politics, or they're coming out of sports.
Right.
Because the entertainment stuff is just so segregated.
It's so splintered. But honestly, one of the, you know, sadly, when Tom Petty passed away a few weeks ago.
Oh, man.
One of the things that this is 100% true. One of the things that popped into my head when I heard the news was the scene that you had with him in the Larry Sanders Show, where you're arguing with him about being bumped to go, and you go, I was nominated for an Oscar. And he goes, for what? Talk soup. And then you guys go at each other. It was so fucking funny. And also at a time where, you know, again, we were just sort of becoming aware of ourselves as an entertainment culture in a way. That the fact that you would go on this show, which was kind of satirizing talk shows and making fun of yourself with Tom Petty, like it was, there were so many layers of it that were so great.
Yeah. I love that show. And, you know, again, it's another sort of touchstone, like we're talking about, of ones that were just such breakthroughs. And fortunately, because of where I live, about a half mile from me was a guy who was living there named Gary Shandling.
Yes.
I was confusing my Gary Larry Shandling Sanders. With my Larry Sanders, yes. Which was easy to do because he was so flipping good in that.
Yeah.
And a terrific, just a great, great guy and a friend. And, you know, I knew him for a long time before he asked me to go on the show, and he didn't ask me to go on it until literally the last one.
Episode,
so
yeah.
I was a little sweaty when Gary finally came to me but I just so admired his work in that and everybody's work. It was off the charts. Great. And then yes, to end up in a green room with Bruno Kirby and Tom Petty and have my little moment was extraordinary. And Petty was pretty good in that, man. He was good. He's like, hey, soup boy. He had that thing. And it's funny because my wife and I were literally talking about StubHubbing tickets last Monday to what would have, I think, was his last concert.
Yeah.
It was the one at the Hollywood Bowl,
right?
2 weeks ago.
Yeah, a couple weeks
ago.
Yeah.
And it was horrible. He's a terrific, what an incredible loss for all of us musically.
I got to interview, I at MTV in 19, I covered the 1995 Video Music Awards. So they had me there, like, interviewing all these bands and people. And so I interviewed Tom Petty. And most of them were, you know, a little serious, on the serious side. And Tom Petty just had this really dry sense of humor. And we did the radio interview. And the end, for no reason, I go, hey, okay, thanks, I've been here with Tom Petty. And for no reason, he just leans into the microphone and goes, we're not wearing pants. And it just was so out of nowhere and funny, because I didn't expect... It was funny because it was Tom Petty.
Yeah.
And he just decided to tell everyone at the end that we're not wearing pants. And then that was the last thing you heard in the interview. It was always one of my favorite entertainment things that ever happened. And it made me fall so in love with him as a person,
right,
that he would just, like, hey, you just fuck around, like, they didn't take it too seriously.
I was so nervous when Gary was like, Greg, you're gonna do it with Tom Petty. And I was like, oh my god, this would be horrible. Tom Petty, I don't even know how to act around a rock star. This will be horrible in every level. And he was same thing, just totally disarming, funny as hell, and flipping great. So
what is the emotional experience of going to the Oscars and being nominated for an Academy Award and trying to not have your brain...
Winning an Academy Award.
Winning an Academy Award. Yes.
Or was I just nominated? You're right. I'm sorry. You were right. I was just nominated. I'm sorry. I can never... It was so long ago. Go ahead.
They're really funny if you're like, no, I won that one. Are you sure? Yeah. No, I want it.
By the way, it works periodically.
Yeah, seriously. You know, like, we're in a world now where you just have to say shit. People won't check it. And then from then on, they'll just say...
We used to call it the award-winning talk soup, and people bought it. So, you know.
I worked on a radio show once in L.A. It was a morning radio show in the 90s, and we just decided to call the show the number one morning show. And then
sure, why not?
And people would go, congratulations on being the number one morning show.
Yeah.
Like, oh, no. We're way at the bottom of the ratings. It's just called the number one morning show, and they'd be like, god damn you.
Right.
Yeah, so you really... And now you can just say anything, and a percentage of people will believe it. So
right.
Anyway, when you were winning here at the Academy Award,
yes,
for As Good As It Gets, I mean, is that... Again, that's sort of another milestone. Is it... how are you staying grounded at this point emotionally and not just spinning off your axis because of that kind of insanity? Did you feel pretty grounded during that period?
I did. I didn't feel ungrounded at that. I mean, it was obviously an incredible thing, and it was a crazy, you know, just a crazy night, you know, and it's incredibly, you know, you are really appreciative of a moment like that in your career. So I was grateful to Jim Brooks for, obviously, that movie was wonderful, and he was great with me in that. But, you know, that was just a crazy event. I mean, suddenly you're at the big show, and I brought my mom and dad, which was fun.
Oh, that's
they
gotta so nice.
Go. Yeah, it was great. Ed and Suze were out there, and we are the car that took us was in a small crash in my garage pulling out shortly before, and there were a few memorable moments from getting to the awards that I won't forget, but yeah, it was cool.
That is me. You didn't win, right? It was you was nominated.
I can't remember. No, I was nominated. Yes,
you were nominated. I'd feel terrible. I was like, you're nominated, and you're trying to, like, subtly tell me, like, no, I actually...
No, if you folks, if you had seen the look in his eyes when he said you were nominated, and I said no, I actually won. I mean, it was... You think these got... It's the same look when he was told of the termite problem here at
That's
the house.
That's right. It was the same kind of, it's all going to come crashing down. And it's like, I don't know if you've ever...
By the way, I've done that before. I too interviewed people at NBC in the wee small hours at one point in my life.
Oh, later.
Later. And I was honestly not particularly good at it. And I would have many moments where suddenly I'd be corrected on something and I'd just try to vamp and get through it, but it was horrible. Horrible.
That's right. That was... Did you go over for Tom Snyder?
Bob Costas.
Bob Costas. Yes. That's right. It was Costas.
Yes. But before Costas, it was Snyder's spot.
Right.
Who Snyder, the one who said, you get your smokers and your tokers at the 1:35 hour. And I think he was right.
He was absolutely right. But it's also, you know, I mean, that time slot is really fun, I think, because of that.
Yeah.
Because you know, again, whenever, and it, you know, whenever the network's not paying too much attention,
oh, yeah,
that's where magic starts to happen.
That's
so
right.
Like with Talk Soup or yeah. That time slot yeah. Really late, You know, and that's where the magic.
Which is what's interesting about today, because with the internet, there's just so much, I think, interesting stuff happening out there, because there's not even a network. It's just total creative freedom happening from, you know, people and in places.
Yeah, because you literally can just take your content right to the audience. Yeah. There's no, well, this guy in a suit's going to decide if I'm okay, cool enough to put on there. Like, it just doesn't even matter. You know, when people always go, how do I get started? And you shouldn't even be asking that question. You have a fucking TV studio in your pocket.
That's right.
You just fucking point it at yourself. Put the selfie mode on and put something on the internet.
That said, we have enough, so please don't take his advice. Yeah, all right? We are in overload right now.
We're saturated, so...
Only you good ones out there bother doing it,
please. I'll tell you what. Just make this the last one, all right? Just this one more. I'm sorry it's so warm in here, too. It's very warm in the room that we're in. I'm sweaty. You don't mind if I take this off, right?
It is hot in here.
It is really hot in here.
But it is about 93 degrees, I saw when I was pulling up to Chris Hardwick's house.
The temperature gauge on my car when I was coming back from breakfast at 105. So I don't know if that was... And this is... The area that we live in, it's real dicey because of fires. Yeah. Like, we're in fire season, which is... We're always, I feel like we're all like meerkats, always just kind of looking around to see if there's any plume of smoke in any direction.
Yeah.
But it is... But the thing is, it doesn't matter what part of the country you live in, it's going to be something. It's either tornadoes or hurricanes or earthquakes or fires. Like, there's nothing is safe, Greg.
Feels like an earthquake. I just think that, I don't know. I've had a funny earthquake feeling for the last, 30 years or so. And sooner or later, it's going to come.
Where were you during the 94 earthquake?
I was living on a place over on Oakhurst. I'm sure the Hollywood Star tourists go by it regularly. I was on Oakhurst Boulevard between Burton and Beverly in a one bedroom apartment with borrowed furniture and a kitchen filled with empty wine bottles at the top, just to show you how cool I was.
Sure.
And when the earthquake hit, somebody had told me to put your shoes on. The number one injury from earthquakes is cut glass on feet getting cut by glass. And so that stayed with me, still stays with me. So I kept my shoes by my bed. I remember putting them on. I don't think there's anything else on. This is not a pretty picture, I know. But I go running out into my hallway, and I hear crunch, crunch, crunch. All those wine bottles had all fallen to the ground, and... You look down and there's nothing but glass. So throw your tennis shoes on if there's an earthquake. And don't act like you listened to this podcast today and you didn't learn a little something, all right?
Yeah, seriously, stop acting like that. So stop posting content, we learned, and then always put your shoes on earthquake. So because Greg Kinnear runs out totally naked but in tennis shoes, everyone else in the building clothed on the ground screaming with bloody feet. So you decide...
Yeah. Yeah, who's laughing now? Who's laughing now? Mr. The people Jankowitz. With the bloody feet or the people with the non-bloody feet who are naked?
They're still there. They might still be there, just like Pompeians, just frozen on the ground.
Yeah.
But you, but then you also, when you're sort of going back to the idea of it being in situations where you like fuck up a fact or can't remember something, you also have kids. So on top of that, a large portion of your brain space is occupied with being a parent.
That's right.
Which I imagine doesn't leave a lot of extra room for things like, you know, what year did this thing happen? Or what award did, you know, like...
Right.
So how do you balance the parent brain, professional brain?
I have a bad memory under all circumstances, but it doesn't serve either of those two categories, unfortunately, very well. There is a requirement for memory in my line of work, and there's a important need for memory in as a parent too. So I try to I use notes. You have a little thing on your phone where you can just type in notes to yourself and remember bits and pieces of everything. And I kind of use that, but I'm not a, that's not a really easy gift for me. And so, parenting, I think I'm a good parent. I mean, I work really hard at it, and we do have, I'm lucky enough to have three great kids, three daughters, and a wife who's just incredibly on it. And so when I'm not there, which is, you know, a good portion of the time, if I'm working, I feel like that I'm covered and that they're being loved and protected. But parenting is, that trumps everything.
Yeah.
For it has for me anyway. And you know, there's always the sense that, gosh, are we doing good enough here? Are we doing well enough here? Are we failing in any areas? It haunts me a little bit. And by the way, I was raised and loved by two great parents. So, I am very lucky in that sense, way more lucky than anything else in that sense. And, so I, as a dad, try to do the best that I can, but there's always a little, a little sense that, could be doing better.
I just can't. And I mean, I would imagine your kids are probably getting to the age where it's like, boys are going to start coming around. And you're going to see that fucking snarky look on a teenage, it's like, it's just that look where they're just like, they don't got to listen to,
Yeah.
And you're like, you better fucking, I will drag you out by the scruff of neck.
Scrotum? Oh, neck. You were going with neck. Okay. I didn't know what you were going to grab.
That's sort of like a penis neck. But just the idea that you it's like, how do you give your kids the freedom that I have to respect them as autonomous creatures who are going to have to start making their own decisions, but still wanting to protect them. I'm like, I know more than you think I know, and I know that person sucks. This person's okay, but that person's probably going to hurt your feeling. Like, you just can't help them that way, can you?
No. And first of all, I'm going to call you. As it turns out, for tips, because that's well said and well thought out. You're way ahead of me. I honestly haven't thought that much about the dating thing, although with three daughters, probably wouldn't be a bad idea to start considering the ramifications of that. They're I have one heading to high school soon, and, I'm just not that worried about it. What worries me about Los Angeles, obviously, is just the community is so, it is separated and segregated, and it geographically it's not a easy place to get around. It's not areas are all separated.
Sure.
There's not it's not like New York, obviously.
No.
It's certainly not like Athens, Greece, where I went to high school, where I was in high school, which was a place where you could take the bus up to this one area and everybody from the school would be hanging out in this one general vicinity. LA is a big sprawling place and offers a lot. And then in that sense, it's a great city, but, in terms of, having a sense of community here, it worries me a little bit.
Yeah. Cause there's no central, it's like every little township is really its own thing. It's
yeah.
Like, this is Studio City. This is Santa Monica. This is Marina Del Rey.
Absolutely.
But there's no, and it very much represents the general mindset here of like, I'm only concerned with me and my immediate vicinity. And I don't really care about, having a larger purpose or a community for the good of the, there's none of that. It's like, this is fucking my neighborhood. I don't give a shit what they're doing over there. I mean, it's so insulated.
It is completely insulated. And it worries me in terms of how you circumvent it and how you, how do you raise a child in that environment and not have some of that just be inherently, instilled in them as they go out into the world, because, I want them to think, bigger and globally and, not the opposite of that.
My biggest fear when my wife and I start to have kids, cause we, obviously you don't pick whatever you get. It's yeah. like, and I was like, I don't know. I mean, she goes, I want all girls. And I go, yeah, they're cooler in the beginning, but then when they become teenagers, then it's really scary. And she goes, yeah, but boys are kind of monsters when they're young. And I go, that's true, but you don't have to worry. It's like when they get older, they're sort of like, it's like, yeah, you just leave a bowl of water in the corner and they're fine.
Yeah.
They're little boys. They're boys. They're going to be fine. But in a kind of narcissism prevalent post-Kardashian era, I just feel like there's not a lot of great role models for young people at the moment.
Yeah.
And so how do you instill them with, like, hey, you know, it's all right to kind of like some vacuous stuff, but yeah, make sure don't ease off on the substance. Like, how do you provide some of that at the same time?
Well, you know, my wife's from the UK, and we do, you know, we have family over there. So we do spend some amount of every year in Europe, and we send some good deal of time here. And, you know, we have friends fortunately around the country, and we try to expose them to as much as we can. You know, in terms of role models, I don't know what to say about that. I mean, you can only, you know, push the brakes or push the accelerator so hard on any particular subject, because you want them to find out the stuff for themselves. They've got to find their own role model.
That's right. That's
I can't dictate to them. And you hope that, you know, that you hope that they'll, you know, find their way. But I don't know. I'm still figuring it out as I go. You're just basically giving me, if it wasn't hot as hell in here before, it's roasting right now.
I'm so sorry. It's so warm in here. I think it's like you come to my house and it's like there's a termite problem now. The air conditioning isn't working the way it should be. What a dump.
I got nothing but trouble as a father in the years to come.
Yeah.
I mean, well, this is horrible.
Yeah. We weren't really sure about whether or not you would win an Academy Award. I mean, I think it's safe to say disaster.
And it's a gun culture in here, people. You're not here, but there's a bunch of guns hanging over my head.
These are all from the 19th century. They're non-working.
Those are cool.
19th century, that's a blunderbuss there. That's, you know.
You collect them?
No, I just, you know, I love, this is going to upset people.
That's popular in Hollywood these days, is to be, to collect various different kinds of muskets.
Well,
go ahead.
I never know when there's going to be a turkey hunt.
Right.
For the first Thanksgiving. No, I just love, if I show you around the house afterwards, you sort of see, like, my wife and I both equally had always kind of wanted to live, like, in a museum when we were growing up.
Why is that?
I don't know. I always loved museums. I always felt very comfortable in them. I loved the sort of the still dioramas and the history and the just seeing what humans have accomplished throughout the centuries.
Wow.
And so, you know, there are various collections of things around the house that I think are very unique and special. And I sort of felt like, oh, I just need to rescue that from being somewhere and display it. And so it's not that, I mean, I'm not a gun person. I love the, and this is going to upset people who actually appreciate the mechanics of how these work, but I appreciate the artistry and the craftsmanship and the aesthetic quality of, you know, and then the balance of all these different types of guns.
And these aren't just normal, but these are actually the most eclectic group I've ever seen.
It's like a long rifle there. There's like a Spanish handgun there, but they're all like mid-1800s roughly.
Mm-hmm.
There's
nothing wrong with having a gun collection. It's okay. You're allowed to have a gun collection.
Yeah. I mean, you know, so if I have a daughter or some kid's going to come over, I'm going to put him in here and just make him stare at that adult. But he's going to be smart enough to know, like, well, none of those work.
By the way, I'm looking at this going, well, I think you've pretty much solved my problem with dating.
Just have a wall. Just have a wall of guns.
So, Herman, tell me about yourself.
I gotta go. As you're just casually polishing the tip of one. I like hunting, Herman. What do you hunt? People who upset my family, mainly. And, you know, boar. But it is going to be, you know, I love talking to people with kids as we're on the precipice of going down that path. Cause I just, what I get back is like, well, you figure it out. You know, you can never prepare for it, and then you sort of figure it out.
I'm glad you're getting that back. I was afraid you were having all sorts of gasping, articulate and clear and clear-minded about how to do this and how to, you know, perfectly execute the raising of children, because I got crickets for you. I'm doing the best that I can.
Honey, I was talking to Greg Kinnear and he doesn't know. He just doesn't know. What are we supposed to, if he doesn't know, how am I supposed to know? Yeah, I don't know. Having a thing in your life that allows you to take the focus off yourself sounds very refreshed. It sounds nice.
Yeah.
Because you have to.
Well, I've overcompensated at this point. I've taken the focus so far off me with three kids. It's not fair. It's not fair to me that they are sucking this much energy and time away from me and my career and the things I want. So I don't know how that happened, but it's just gone bananas.
Do you still... Do you like schedule dad time? Or family time? You're like on every this day of the week we are gonna get together and have dinner.
We do dinner as a family as often as we can, which is fairly often when I'm in town. And the golfer Phil Mickelson, who has daughters, actually gave me the tip to have breakfast with them, just one.
Yeah.
Because he's got like nine or so. I don't know how many kids he has.
He's got a lot.
And I thought that was good advice. And so I try to do that, just to have a little one-on-one breakfast every now and then, or a one-on-one lunch. And the idea of it's a different thing when mom's there, when we're all doing it as a family. But to have the one-on-one thing is a good thing to try and schedule in every once in a while.
That and choke up on your wedge. When you're chipping.
That's right. You know, he was adamant about that.
Through on your...
Yeah.
Breakfast one-on-one and choke up on you. Do you still play golf? Do you play golf?
I do. I was just in Scotland playing in a tournament there called the Dunhill, which is kind of like the AT&T, only you get paired with a European pro and you play 3 days. And if you make the cut, you're back at the old course on day four, I never have made the cut at this tournament. Ever, and almost finished in last place this year. So the golf is another tough area that you've really managed to nail me on.
Well, this is a gotcha podcast. You know, I bring people on.
My God.
And I really just, it's sort of like...
Ghost of Mike Wallace is here right now.
It's the verbal equivalent of what a paparazzi does. It's like I try to get like a really, like a weird pause face moment.
Yeah.
But emotionally.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's really part of the dissection process.
But I do play. I'm not great, but I'm probably a 9, like 8 or 9 handicap. And I love the game. I always have. Liked it as a kid and stopped for a lot of years. But I do play it once in a while.
I know you're technically here to talk about the movie, which is it the same kind of different as me?
Do you think that's a problem that we can't remember the name of the title?
I remembered it though.
You did call it correctly, but I think it's based on a book. It was on the New York Times bestseller list for 3 years. Same kind of different as me, but it's just the wording of that is tricky. I mean, it's in a world where people have so much information coming from them, I worry about that title, same kind of different as me, being easily falling off the tongue when it's time to pick the movie on Friday.
But, so you're here to promote the different is the same as you. Well, that's close. So it's kind of different than,
it isn't different than the same kind, is it?
It's the same as the different kind of sameness.
Kind of
as I am.
Different as the same of what you're saying it
we
is.
We are the different same. Shit. God, I'm sorry.
Same kind of different as me.
Same kind of...
There it is.
Different and the same.
By the way, when you hit it, it's fantastic, but it just takes a while.
It's like the Pee-wee's Playhouse, like secret word of the day where all the furniture goes nuts. Yeah, everything goes crazy. Is that? But you're also I'm also really excited about the Philip K. Dick series.
Yes,
Electric Dreams.
Yeah, Electric Dreams is an anthology. They did 10 episodes. Everybody just dove in and did one, and mine was based on the father thing, which is story about a father who a little boy actually whose father he thinks is changing into an alien and has to come to grips with that. Is it true? Is it not true? You'll have to tune in.
It's really interesting because now that Black Mirror has been on for a couple seasons, there might be young people who go, oh, Philip K. Is this like Black Mirror? It's like, no, Black Mirror was like Philip K. Dick.
Yes, exactly. Like,
it was before the, and I think there was Channel 4, didn't they do a British version of Electric Dreams?
Yes, no, this is the same version.
This is the same version.
We did 5 of them in the UK.
Got
we
it.
Did 5 of them in Chicago. Chicago, maybe one in New York, but you know, there were five US episodes and then there were five shot in the UK.
Yeah. Do you ever write? Did you ever want to write and direct anything?
Yeah, I've written a little bit in my over the years, but I definitely wanted to direct for many, many years, and I did a film with a wonderful cast that is not out yet. Will, I believe, be out this spring. It's called Phil.
Much simpler
title. Philosophy of Phil, which, by the way, I think we got to get rid of philosophy because I like just the simplicity of Phil, particularly in light of the conversation we just had. But it's with Emily Mortimer and Luke Wilson, Robert Forster, and Bradley Whitford's in it, and a number of great actors. Wow. And it was really fun to do. I enjoyed the film. It was a very personal story, and I don't know. Are you in it as well? Yes, you are in it as well.
So you directed yourself.
Yes, and that was a lot. There's a reason. Doc Rivers is a friend of mine, coach of the Clippers. He said, "Greg, there's a reason that I sit on the sidelines," and I think there is genuinely I have such an appreciation. Certainly of those who have done both, who have been able to put themselves in the piece and, you know, in some cases, write it, do everything, direct it. But I really felt when I did this, and I'm very happy with the movie. I think it's a cool film, but you learn how much or how valuable that is to have someone outside the scope of what's happening,
right?
To watch it, to juggle it, to feel it. And it was a crazy process to do both, but something I'd wanted to do for a long time.
And to anyone who is about to embark on a directing career, what would you say was the most valuable thing? What is the most valuable piece of advice you could give?
Casting. Mm-hmm. Which has been said before. I'm not the first person to say that. You have to having the right people in the right roles will serve you way beyond what, you know, almost anything else you can do. And certainly just a genuine connection to the material you're doing. I had a couple of close calls over the years of doing something, and I just never felt it. I never felt the story. I never connected with it and as deeply as I want to, as deeply as I needed to. This story felt, you know, just right. And I think that is an easy thing to overlook as a director. Of course, you know, you're going to have a connection to something you're going to direct, but man, I mean, it's gotta be all in. There can't be any hesitations at all.
Yeah. Especially cause everyone's looking to you to know how everything's going to work.
But I think that happens. I do think it sounds obvious, but I think there are people because somebody ends up having a directing career. They're doing 5 movies or 10 movies or 20 movies, not necessarily every one of them is going to necessarily deeply resonate with them.
Right.
My friends, John and Val, who just did the movie with Steve on the, with a tennis film.
Oh yes. You mean the,
come on.
Battle of the Sexes.
That's a good title, and I can't even remember it. See, I told you I had memory issues. Battle of the Sexes. John and Val have done 3 movies. It started with Little Miss Sunshine. They, did Ruby Sparks and this. I mean, think about that. That's over the course of, like 11, 12 years.
Right.
13, 14 years. Jim Brooks, there are those directors who have the ability to be very selective and not, work very often and really only respond when they are deeply, deeply connected to the material, which I think always produces something special. But if you're doing your first thing, man, you gotta love it.
When does this movie come out? Do you have any idea?
I think April of 2018.
Is there anything that you haven't done yet that you still want to do? Is there anything? Any kind of, it doesn't even have to be entertainment related. Was there anything else where you feel like someday I'm going to just go do that thing, but not yet?
No, I don't think so. I think I've, been fortunate enough to, kind of do a lot of different things and so far, there's no, at least right now, there's not something that I'm deeply chasing. I've enjoyed, you know, trying to mix it up.
Well, you seem well adjusted and it's just like a happy, normal guy.
Yeah.
Which I think is, I mean, it's, which even asking you like, well, was it crazy when all this stuff was happening? You're like, oh, no, it seemed fine. I mean, is it, I wonder, is that just because you had good parents and a stable childhood and you were comfortable growing? Were you comfortable as a teenager?
Who was the guy that was sitting in this chair that you were saying, hey, how are the Academy Awards? And they were like, oh, it sucked. It was crazy. I mean,
some people can, you know, like,
angst more.
Yes. Anxiety, you know, just sort of the stress of it all, or the like, well, this was crazy or mind blowing or not at all what I, you know. Because it's a very strange environment. It's a very artificial environment. It's a very, you know, if people are looking to that to provide all the meaning in their soul, then they will probably be very disappointed, right. You know? So it's, but
no, I think that's true. And I don't think that I've, you know, for me, I of course I care what I do. I you know, really do care about if I'm doing a film, television, whatever. I care about it. I want it to be good. Not just me. I want the whole thing to be good. I care. And I sit in a screening of a film or you know, anything. If I'm watching it and I'm a part of it, of course I want the audience to resonate with it. I want it to matter to them. And yet at the same time, it's just, I don't think that, you know, and it's changed over the years. There were probably times where I was much more, certainly earlier, grinding on the idea of, God, this has got to work. And, you know, I guess, you know, with family or with, you know, children, maybe my priorities have moved certainly and shifted, but, so I still do care, but yeah, I'm not, I don't have a lot of deep anxiety, although that might just be because your room is so warm and relaxing. I'm in a couch, by the way.
We're not wearing pants.
We're not wearing pants, man. I'm in a couch. This couch, who wouldn't be relaxed on this couch?
This belonged to Lydia's grandparents, this couch.
Oh, is that true?
Yeah.
It's so comfortable, man.
It's super comfy.
You want to sell it? Would you sell it?
Just take it. She's not going to. I mean, you know, they've had it long enough, I think.
You wouldn't sell it.
300. Oh, my God. No.
There'd be no possible way you would sell it.
Well, I don't know. What are we talking about here?
You're like the museum guy. I don't know. I think everything in a museum has a price on it to some, you know, that I don't buy that priceless thing.
Listen,
so.
I'm not going to sell it. But if I were going to, like, what are we talking about here? Like, it's funny. I actually reached out to, I know one of the people who works at the museum, the Natural History Museum in New York. And foolishly, a few years ago, I just reached out and I was like, you don't happen to have any just like specimens of anything in a closet that you would sell? And she was like, heavens no. Like asking a museum if they would sell you something. I just felt like a dirty artifact addict where I was like, just a skeleton, anything, you know, but they don't do that sort of thing. They won't do it. But we love, you know, this couch you're on has been in been her family for a few generations and it's still in very good shape.
I admire that you went to the Natural History Museum and asked them if they had any specimens.
I'm not real proud of that. Because even after she responded, she was taken aback by the nature of the question.
Yeah. No, still talking about it.
I'm sure it's
There's
still...
another podcast going called Museums Today, and she's like, and this son of a bitch, this greedy son of a bitch starts saying, hey, what sort of a fire sale are you having over there?
What are we, a fucking, are we like a secondhand IKEA store where you can just come in and buy
with your Hollywood money, your dirty Hollywood money and buy things up from the public? I don't think so, pal.
In fact, we're going to come take some of your shit because going back to Harrison Ford, it belongs in a museum. It belongs in a museum. Yeah, no, you know, it's funny because
is that a line from Harrison Ford?
It's a line from Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Of course.
It's like, you know, there he's going after the Ark, you know, you and no, he's having, right. It belongs in a museum.
You're right.
But even you know, when I think back to you on Talk Soup, I think of a really confident, comfortable guy on camera, and there was no, you know, there was no sense of desperation, which it was a very interesting thing in comedy because there's a lot of comedy where you can feel like, and I'm of course thinking about my own in general, where the audience can tell like, this guy needs us. He needs us to like him. And yours was just a very like, hey, I'm here and you're invited to come along to this. But if you don't want to, it's fine. You know, like there was just a comfort level to it.
Yeah, there's a real advantage to not having any friends to begin with.
You got nothing to lose. Yeah, yeah. Well, I guess, so when does the same...
Same kind of different as me.
The different than sameness.
Comes out on the 20th of October. A lovely movie, by the way. Jaimin Hansu, John Voight, Renee Zellweger. Based on this book, it's about homelessness. It's about... helping, reaching out, you know, to people of completely different parts of the universe. A guy, Ron Hall, true story, and forming this friendship with Denver Moore, who co-wrote the book with him. They became, you know, sort of lifelong friends, raised close to $100 million for homelessness. You live, if you're in Los Angeles listening to this, ground zero for homelessness. It is a, you know, it's an epic problem. And this story is just about, it's about, I really like it. It's about the tendency for us to want to write a check to help the problem. God, do we do that here in town?
Oh, yeah.
And that's okay. We need money. We need resources. But this story is about actually forget the check that you want to write and hand off and go to the dinner or whatever. This is about putting yourself out there. And as uncomfortable as that can be, putting yourself on the line, putting your actions into work and trying to contribute to the problem with yourself by what you do. And it's I think it's a worthwhile story, especially in a, you know, given the temperature of the last year.
And we're, what do you mean?
I mean temperature
of this room.
In terms of crap happening in the world, you know, politically and in terms of, you know, natural disasters and in terms
everything's
of...
Not, so everything's not going awesome right now? It's crazy. So you're saying that there are biblical signs that we are standing on the edge of the end of our civilization.
What a time, right?
It's such a strange time.
I mean, like, you add this stuff up and it's amazing. Now I feel like we're just going from one thing to another, you know, and it's exhausting and terrifying.
When is Electric Dreams come out? Do you know, have a date for that?
That comes out, I believe end of October, but I'm not really sure.
Okay.
Sony, I'm so sorry.
Well, it's
on Amazon.
It's on Amazon. So they'll tell you.
Yeah, they'll tell you. And I'm sure you can click and watch them all.
And the cast, it's like everyone.
We call that binging.
Binging. You can binge it all at once.
Binge it all you want.
Binge, just gorge
yourself.
I like this thing. I need 20 of this thing ASAP.
Yeah. Yeah.
So last thing, because this has become a gotcha podcast.
Oh, boy.
Any good embarrassing story of like, oh, I met this really famous person and then this weird thing happened or I was in this situation. Like any really good... And I ran up to this person and I said this thing and I wish I hadn't said that thing.
Who's giving you the best answer on that one?
I don't really ask that question. We used to ask that question.
Sure, of course not. Bring Kinnear in here. Set him in.
I just
set him up.
Just brought it up for you.
He won't know what to do with that. Don't give it to the other guys. Keep that little nugget for Kinnear.
You know, because Kinnear
freak
can
him
take
out.
The hard
have an
pitches.
Answer.
Kinnear can take the curveballs. Most people need an underhanded softball pitch.
Okay, well, that's making me feel better. I am going through the Rolodex as you speak, as you start to bolster my confidence about myself.
Kinnear can do anything. He can handle anything. He's superhuman, if you will.
Oh, gosh, it was so long ago. But, all right, so here's one. Harvey Korman.
Oh, that's a fantastic one.
Okay, Harvey Korman.
Yep.
Meanwhile, your audience is like, okay, I'm switching over to, you know.
Oh, my God. Comedy people know who Harvey Korman is.
So great. So brilliant. Genius. I'm a young whippersnapper. This is prior to Talk Soup. And I'm got a microphone and a guy with a camera. And I'm at this event. I'm supposed to get some interviews of people and anything I can to try and fill time on Movie Time. Before E was E, it was Movie Time. And so... I'm walking down a hall and here comes, I had just done an interview with Harvey a little bit earlier, briefly, just a brief show business knick-knack interview about whatever, and he's walking down the hall with his two granddaughters, and I stop him and I say, "Mr. Corman, hi, how are you? Remember, I'm Greg. I saw you downstairs." And he kind of didn't really remember me. He was like, "Oh, hi, how are you?" He's very nice. And I said, "And look who's got their granddaughters here. And hell, what's your name?" And I'm doing my butter up, the best sort of sweaty butter up I can do to a celebrity. And he stops me and says, "See, now that is you projecting what you think this case is, but as it turns out," what did you say your name is? "Greg." He goes, "As it turns out, Greg, these are my daughters." And I didn't feel very good about that. And it created a long, awkward silence as they walked off.
So you were really old when they, excuse me.
Well, he was very old at that time. I mean, I don't know. It just seemed weird that, you know, now I probably wouldn't make that assumption, but at the time it was just, I don't know, a kid, you know, out of...
What you got to do, you know, he's a comedy guy, you double down on the bit and go, "Is that what they told you?"
Yeah.
"Oh, no."
No, you've got all the, are you not kidding? Do you think, I had thousands of great follow-up lines as I rode the elevator downstairs, thousands of them, but at the time it was just sheer horror.
Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, it was bad.
That's a good one. That's
not a good one. I feel like there's really, really good ones. I do shit like this all the time. I'm always putting my foot in my mouth. Every day I come home and I feel like there's a list of them and I have nothing for you, Chris.
You didn't?
Nothing.
When you showed up on the set of As Good As It Gets, you didn't push your hair back and do Jack Nicholson at Jack Nicholson? So that didn't happen?
I never did anything, you know, with Jack that I would, you know, recount for you. That would
remember
be,
when you traveled were in with Batman?
Him, I had nothing. No, I don't have a good one. I don't have a good one with him.
That's all right, Greg. Yeah. We got the Harvey Cormans, and that's enough.
Yeah, all right.
That's enough for today. But this is also gives you a good assignment to go out and embarrass yourself in some horrible way with someone and then come back and talk about it.
Oh, the drive home. This is going to be such a good interview on my drive home. I cannot tell you
I've loved
I'm
having you on
so many
because
spots.
You were so nice to me. You were so nice to me back then, and I was such a fan of yours before I started working in television. And so you're just someone that I'm always happy to see do well, and I always root for you. And I just, I don't know. I really always, because it is important, like when you meet people who are just starting out and you're nice to them and you encourage them, they never forget it. Yeah. I've never forgotten how nice you were to me back then.
Well,
so
I'm sure glad I was. And as I say, you've done extremely well, and I am extremely happy to come and do this show because I'm a fan as well.
Oh, thanks,
this
man.
Is great.
Well, Academy Award winner Greg Kinnear has been here today. 100% true. Don't even look it up. And thanks for being here.
Yeah, man, this is great.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
In the climate-ravaged year of 2072, the city of Pura stands as a miraculous green haven, a geoengineered paradise that protects fortunate residents from the global catastrophes of heat domes, fires, floods, and droughts. Demetria Lopez heads up Pura's public relations, tirelessly promoting the city's idyllic image. But when she stumbles upon a dark secret that, if exposed, would be the downfall of Pura's existence, she must decide who and what she is willing to protect. From Wondery, the makers of Academy and Dr. Death, The Last City stars actors Reyes Seahorn, Jeannie Tirado, and Maury Sterling. Follow The Last City on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Last City early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.